5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So it's been said by one or two people in the know that London is the place to be if you're in helium. Now, why is that? Let's talk to Andy Carroll. He runs Mossman Oil and Gas and recently moved into the helium space in America himself. The company's making some progress over there. But before we get to that, what is it about helium that's become attractive in the way that we weren't really seeing helium companies 10 years ago, Andy?
Oh, it's a really interesting story. So helium has increasing supply, reducing because of just age of fields that have been producing for 100 years. And demand is really picking up, going to semiconductor manufacturers, space rockets, and a wide range of resources, but increasing MRI machines and other use scientific instruments. So helium is becoming more used at the same time as the supplies and the storage are running out. So I think smart investors in London have spotted the opportunity, and it's become a center or a place to come and talk about helium, and it's got good support from the market.
What's involved with helium exploration? Because it seems to sort of straddle the worlds of mining and oil and gas when it comes to the the way investors look at it. Is it more similar to the oil and gas industry, or does it bear some similarities to mining as well?
More to the oil and gas. It is a gas. It does come out of the ground if it can. So very much gas would be the nearest commodity. I think perhaps what makes it a little different is it's not flammable. So some of the regulations are different, and sometimes that can provide a lower cost. So, for example, we'll be drilling wells in the near future in Colorado, pairing up with a company that has figured out they can do it under water well drilling licenses. Very easy regulation, very low cost regulation, but a great cheap way to drill wells and determine what the gas content is and what the reservoir qualities are without all the expensive infrastructure you'd have if it was a flammable gas. So it is an interesting somewhere in between the two. You avoid the explosive and flammable nature of hydrocarbons, but otherwise a lot of the drilling techniques, and it is a gas, so it goes into pipelines and compressors, so much more like gas once you get it out of the ground.
So how do you go about finding helium then? Talk us through the sort of process from start to wellhead, as it were.
Sure. So large amounts of helium have been found in the process of drilling wells for oil and gas. So a good example is in the Four Corners area of USA, which is Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, but also down into Kansas. One of the biggest fields is a gas field in Kansas. It happens to have about 1% helium. So this was been extracted. This 1% has been extracted and stored since about 1930. And it's been stored in a big salt cavern in Texas. But about 10 years ago, the US government decided this was costing too much money, and they started to sell it down and sold out all the helium that was in storage. The reason that the US government got involved is way back in the 1930s, when Nazi Germany was looking at dirigible balloons and hydrogen exploded. So the big switch was to helium. Helium became a strategic, important commodity, and the US government privatized it. So the area that we're looking at in Colorado is close to a field that was produced from 1928 to 1930. It had 8% helium, which is about as good as you get in terms of a high percentage. But it was shut in by the US government because they nationalized the whole industry and shut down the private industry. So it's kind of interesting that there hasn't been a great exploration industry and exploration techniques or processes. So it's really over the last 10 years, as the price has started to become significantly attractive, it can be 100 times the price of natural gas. Geologists started to go wake up and realize they're going to make more money out of helium than they will out of natural gas. The skill set is very much the same in terms of reservoirs and how gas sits in rocks and moves through rocks. But helium is sourced from the radioactive materials in the crust and in the base of the Earth. So when uranium or thorium change their isotope form, they give off helium. Helium will come up and come to surface and escape unless there's a really good seal. So we know where it comes from, deep in the Earth, maybe 5,000 meters, depending on different areas where the depth of the source actually is. And then you look for a trap, as you do with hydrocarbons, but you need a very good trap, and that tends to be a salt bed. So strangely, when you look at the surface of the Earth, you wouldn't guess where these salt beds are. But for example, in Central Australia, where you still have some salt beds in South Australia, in Central Australia, the big inland seas and widespread salt beds that were subsequently covered in sand and now just appear to be sandy desert. But underneath, the salt beds are holding helium and hydrogen, and there's quite high concentrations in that part of the world. And that's actually where we started off with our licenses, and initially focusing on hydrocarbons with the standard process. But as the price of helium increased, these assets suddenly became very valuable for their helium potential, more so even than their hydrocarbon potential. But we have now shifted from that area, which has still got a lot of potential but is fairly high in its cost, to the US. And the other advantage of the US is the significant infrastructure in terms of helium pipelines, helium plants, and the market. So there's enormous investment in semiconductor manufacture in Arizona. Some companies are spending $60 billion in setting up new semiconductor manufacturing plants, which need helium. Helium is the inert gas which purges the machinery, so they get the purity that they need. So it's absolutely essential and irreplaceable for semiconductor manufacture. So we're seeing the price of Nvidia and other chip manufacturers going through the roof. They all need helium as part of their process. So that's in Arizona. The storage was in Kansas. There's quite a lot of infrastructure around that part of the US. And that's also where there's a significant potential for helium. And we know that from quite a number of helium fields in that area that have been found when people drilling for oil and gas, particularly back in the 1980s when the oil price went crazy. But back through history, people have drilled wells in that area and found helium. Previously, it wasn't commercial. It would be shut in. They'd walk away if it was gas, particularly if it's non-flammable gas. But there's a lot of good data. And so it's really a fairly new focus to just explore for helium. And it's a very interesting, very rapidly development in terms of technology. It's not that much different, but really in terms of technical focus on looking at where is the helium. It's a relatively small number of people that have had that focus. And we're very pleased to have teamed up with guys that have been doing that for 10 years. And we now see companies, so London-based companies like Helium One just announced this morning that they successfully drilled and found gas. And I think their share price is up 20 or 30% this morning. So the market is very keen to see the news. We're seeing London-based companies exploring in the US. That one's in partnership with a company that's been working there for some time. We've gone into partnership with a company that's based in Colorado, understands the local rules and regulations. So it's a really emerging area, which is quite fascinating, both technically in terms of the exploration potential and the uses of the gas. A number of industries just can't do without helium.
So you mentioned the manufacturers of the likes of Nvidia. I believe it's quite important to be close to your customer base, because shipping helium does involve a certain amount of leakage. Is that correct, or is that overstating it?
No, it's true. It's such a small molecule that it'll it's used for leak detection, because it's one of the gases that will leak most easily. If there is a leak, it'll find it. And transport is not easy. So I think the other thing is, geopolitically, you look at what's happening. USA has been a big supplier, but it's now a huge consumer. Other places like have some helium supplier, Qatar and Russia. So if you're a semiconductor manufacturer in Arizona, you're not going to be wanting to look too far outside the States for your helium supply. So the security of supply is really important, and that we think that's a good reason to be in the US. It's pro-business. That's where the demand is, and that's happens to be where there's a lot of helium being produced and a lot of helium potential to be explored and discovered.
So does that mean there's not a lot of helium that gets shipped across the Atlantic, for example? I mean, that kind of transportation activity, not very widespread.
Yeah, it's possible. You have to liquefy it, which takes a lot of energy, and then transport it as a liquid in ceramic containers to reduce the amount of wastage. So anything that's cryogenic is a big energy consumer, and it can be done. You know, gas is shipped around the world in LNG ships, but it's a big capital, a lot of infrastructure required, and not so energy efficient. So that'll be reflected in the pricing too. Pricing of helium is an interesting aspect as well. The high purity gets a very high price, but obviously there are processing charges to go through the multiple stages of purification. So extremely high price for very pure helium, but often it comes out of the ground mixed with CO2, It's relatively simple to separate those two gases. But there is processing and transportation cut charges, which again can be done, but it can be a lot of capital investment, and that takes time if you're trying to start on a greenfields site. But a lot of that is available in the US, already established.
So you mentioned earlier in the conversation that helium occurs with natural gas in a lot of instances. Is it the case that that is the way helium normally occurs, and that there are fewer primary helium deposits, or is it simply that the natural gas deposits have been more widely exploited over the years, so that's how we know about the helium that comes with them?
So it's a combination of circumstances. The helium is generated separately from the hydrocarbons and generated from a different source, but both the hydrocarbon gases and the helium will rise to the surface until they are constrained by a seal. So if you have a really good seal, like a salt bed, you'll get hydrocarbons trapped underneath that salt layer, and the helium trapped under the salt layer, along with typically carbon dioxide or some other gases. So basically, all the jet gases that are generated under the seal will be tapped into with the discovery well and the production well, and produced all together, and then separated at the surface. So we think it, well, we know it's more commercial to find the deposits that have a higher helium content and less of the gases that you don't want. I mean, natural gas is economic in the US. Carbon dioxide does have a market, but we certainly prefer to look and hope to find something closer to 10% helium rather than the 1% helium. Just around the processing costs of having to separate out and manage the other gases. So it can be done, but we're looking at areas where we see high helium percentage and less of the other gases that we're not so keen on.
So, for those who didn't or can't remember their O-level GCSE chemistry or the equivalents in the US and Australia, so helium generally occurs as an element. If I'm right, stop me there, Andy, if I'm already wrong, but.
Yeah, so it pairs up, so you get two helium atoms quickly joined together and form a very stable HE2 molecule. That molecule is so stable that I can't think of any compound that forms with helium, as opposed to, say, hydrogen, where so helium and hydrogen are two of the most commonly formed molecules, or atoms, I should say. But once helium goes into a combination as a Siamese twin, it's very, very stable, whereas hydrogen gets pulled off into water and multiple other chemical compounds. So you don't often find helium, sorry, hydrogen by itself, but helium doesn't combine with anything else. So when you do find it, it's by itself.
So when you're talking about it occurring with these hydrocarbons in these traps and salt areas, the helium is occurring as an element, but it is mixed in. It's a mixture rather than a compound, I suppose.
Yeah, so the helium gas is a stable molecule, but it will be in the gas stream with other gases like nitrogen, which is also relatively stable, carbon dioxide, which is a bit less stable, but will come out of the ground, and then typically separated through temperature, through cryogenic treatment, where you liquefy and separate it out in a fractionation column, and then You either keep it liquid or gasify it. You can transport as liquids. Typically, natural gas ends up in a pipeline going off to a power station, but you start having separate designated pipelines. So once you separate it once, you don't really want to have to separate it again. So there are a few options for transporting helium. There are now some small plants. So in that cryogenic separation plant, you can then take the helium off as a liquid and you can transport it in a road tanker, kind of like a petrol tanker, except it's a bit more sophisticated. But the technology of the separation and the transport has really come along in the last 5 years or so, and is now you can now rent these units to do the liquefaction, and you can the people who buy the helium and then do the purification and processing of helium will come and pick it up. So it starts to become like a milk run going around the picking up the milk. I mean, this is helium companies, helium marketing companies going around collecting the helium.
And is it an expensive process to undertake the separation of helium from its other partners in the ground?
There's a reasonable amount of energy consumption required, but the price of helium is so high that the operating costs are relatively not the issue. It's finding the helium and getting the quantity of helium, and then because of the strong price, the operating costs are pretty good, especially if you're up around, you know, more than 1% helium. So the break even at the moment seems to be around 0.5% to 1% helium in the gas stream. More than that, it's seemed to be clearly economic. Less than that, people seem to find it too small and not bother separating it.
Right. So what, you talk about the helium price. What is the helium price? Tell us a little bit about where it's at and where it's come from.
Yeah, so we've got a chart on our website. When it was a significant amount of storage in the Texas, Kansas area with the US government, and demand wasn't very strong, the price of helium was similar to the price of natural gas, a few dollars per 1,000 cubic feet. But now, it's in the last 5 years, it's gone out about 100 times the price of natural gas. So that's, we're talking, depending on the purity, it can be $800 or $900 per 1,000 cubic feet. Which is, but you know, that's the high purity, but it's it then varies back down the supply chain, but it's still very strong pricing. So typically $300 or $400 dollars a 1,000 cubic feet.
So when you talk about purity, you're talking about material which hasn't been completely separated from the other gases which it's occurred with.
Yeah, you're looking to go into semiconductor manufacturing and for medical hospital uses, you're talking 99 point and a string of nines percent. If it's going into helium balloons, then people aren't so bothered about the purity of it.
Yeah. Is that a big market for helium balloons?
Not really, but I think it's the one place that people have noticed the price of helium. Suddenly, party balloons have suddenly got very expensive.
Right. So does this mean that party balloons might end up being less buoyant in the future as people dilute with other material?
Yeah, I suspect there'll be a bit of watering down going on.
Yeah. So tell us, Andy, where are the main, what are the main helium producing areas in the world? You've talked about the USA and Australia. Are those the key areas? Are there any others?
So they're two of the biggest. Qatar has a huge gas production with a small helium percentage. Algeria is the same, and Russia. So they're the countries that have the resources and have had production, not so much in Australia in terms of production. So yeah, very much the US, Qatar, and Russia.
And is there any one country or company that's capable of moving the price in a similar way that OPEC does with oil, or De Beers used to be able to do with diamonds?
Not that's been identified so far. It's a broad enough market, and we haven't seen anything like an OPEC group trying to control the prices. I think it's more multiple users suddenly getting worried about the price and buying more long-term contracts. The spike prices can be pretty scary and pretty spiky when there is a shortage. So I think security of supply is going to be more and more important. It's not a big part of the cost of a semiconductor, but it's irreplaceable. And so that's kind of shifts the thinking about it.
Is there any kind of a spot market?
There is, yeah. Yeah, in various parts of the world. Yes, it's quite a active traded spot markets in different places.
So if investors want to see what the helium price is, it's not particularly opaque in the way that some other commodities can be.
No, it's not. It's not opaque. There is also not really a very good single market. So the oil price, you might look at WTI or Brent. Gold price is quoted. So it might be a bit more like gold price. You know, no one's been able to corner the market on gold. You can find out what the price is. I'm trying to think, is there a standard place you go to for gold price? But it just, I guess it's NYMEX is the generally reported, and everyone seems to be comfortable working off that. But obviously you can go into a shop in Dubai and buy gold, and they'll weigh it and they'll give you a price. I'm not quite sure where they get their price from, but you know, a well understood gold is up or gold is down every day.
Yeah, well, there's the AM and the PM fix in London, which always used to be the way it was set on the European market. But so does that mean that the likes of Nvidia will, to an extent, benchmark the price they pay to a spot price, or do they just work it out on their own?
So they'll have marketing groups that are making sure they get their supply. But I'll be honest, that's a bit further down the supply chain than we're active at the moment.
So a company like Mosman will be aiming to produce helium and sell it as a mixture, will it? I mean, you talked about purification a few minutes ago. What would the plan be for a company like yours? Would it be to sell a sort of 99.99% product, as you referred to the medical industry once, or is it sort of lower down the scale that you guys pitch into?
Yeah, because we're small market cap and would look to manage that larger capital investments. We can look to, as a company operating in Colorado, where we're exploring, that's got a neat setup, and they have a plant. They've rented the cryogenic equipment, and the buyers come by with a truck and take it from the facility, and that minimizes their capital investment in that infrastructure. So they're able to sell at the plant gate, and that's what we would look to do. So that's in one part of Colorado. Another part of Colorado, where we just acquired some leases, there's a gas pipeline that goes through those lease areas. That's physically connected to a helium plant. So upon success, we would be able to put helium through that pipeline and deliver it to the helium plant. And we'll get a better price at the helium plant than we would for having a truck come by and pick it up.
So it's like many of these projects, existing infrastructure can be quite helpful.
Yeah, both in terms of capital and the time that it takes to establish planning permission and all the approvals required in this day and age.
So what would be a what would count as a big discovery of helium in terms of cubic feet?
Yeah, so we had some numbers on our project in Australia, and we're talking about over 200 billion cubic feet. So we're talking significant quantities of potential. The if you take any prospective resource and multiply it by the current helium price, you get quite mind-boggling dollar numbers. And that's obviously appeal is in the size of the prize. The challenge is to move through from the discovery through to the production phase, manage bringing in partners and finance to avoid the typical transition from exploration to production without having too many capital dilutions, how to bring in the right partners. But the size of the prize is enormous, so it's very, very big upside on finding the project that works in the right place.
Are there any helium deposits that run into the trillions of cubic feet as we see in natural gas?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Exxon runs one of the very large fields in the US that supplies, I think it's 20% of world supply of helium at the moment. And that would, over its life, that's the LaBarge field. And I don't know the number at my fingertips, but that would be, I'd imagine, yeah, we'd better look it up, but there are some very, very large fields. The large fields in Qatar, which are being liquefied and shipped, they're in the TCF size of gas field, but it may only be 1% or 0.5% of that, which is helium. So there are some very large fields around, but yeah. In the US, you can look at probably more what's a typical natural gas size of field, and where they're normally close to 100% natural gas for various reasons, mainly around how hard it is to contain the helium. You're usually talking of somewhere between 1 and 10% that's actually helium, and whether the rest of it's natural gas or carbon dioxide or something else that's gets generated in those formations. You don't always get up to the 100% level, but underneath these extensive salt beds, there's no reason why there can't be some very large deposits. We have some identified on 3D seismic that we're looking to quantify. We don't have the numbers just yet. But certainly significant potential.
I mean, talking of 3D seismic, how do you tell when you've got helium on your seismic as opposed to natural gas or CO2? Can you is that an easy process to manage?
Yeah, good question. Basically, seismic tells you information around the speed of sound through the rock. It doesn't tell you what's in the holes in the rock. So the benefit of 3D seismic is it gives you very precise targets for drilling structures. So what we're looking for is where where the high spots are underneath the salt bed where it's got deformed over time. So we can identify the structure on the seismic, and that de-risks a significant part of the drilling. But the actual fluid content needs to be penetrated and tested. So if you're in an area where you're surrounded by helium fields, then you have a reasonable indication. And some of the wells that were drilled for oil and gas had the gas tested. Sometimes it was just noted to be non-flammable gas. Sometimes it was actually sampled, and you got definitive numbers. But yeah, it kind of depends case by case.
So does that mean that if you're going out looking for helium, you very well might find natural gas and not find helium?
So the areas we're looking, there is the potential, but you can tell by what has been found in other wells around what it's almost not certain, but the geologist can figure out what the gas migration has been from source and where it is trapped. And we prefer to look where it's got high helium concentrations, demonstrated by, for example, that field that produced from 1928 to 1930 in Colorado. That was called Model Dome. That had somewhere between 7 and 11% helium. Those are the we'll be looking just to the north and just to the south of that area. You can't actually access it now. It's an army or air force firing range across it, so you can't access the old location. But if you look north to south, you can expect to get similar kind of helium results. Further to the east, we know there are higher carbon dioxide concentrations. And then there are other areas where you get hydrocarbons and helium. But they're not the main focus areas that we're looking in.
So in your case, it sounds like there's some pretty good clues. If you were moving into sort of virgin territory in a hypothetical scenario, looking for helium, would your first step be to shoot seismic? How would you go about it?
Yeah, so it's similar to hydrocarbons. You kind of want to look where it's already been found and extrapolate trends. So I wouldn't go and start in the middle of nowhere. You can get airborne seeps, or you can ground sample. That's got some mixed results. But really, if you've got a a field to the east of you, and a field to the west of you, and a field to the south of you, then you're probably looking in the right place.
Right.
Look where it's already been found and produced, so for example, the one lease that we bought was extensively drilled for oil and is still producing oil at about 6,000 feet. The salt beds at about 7,000 feet, and the helium reservoirs are at 8,000 feet. So there were a number of wells drilled, and we can now see from looking at the seismic that quite a few of those wells were just off target for testing the structure. So we now have the knowledge of what was found when they drilled the wells, but also the knowledge that they might be half a mile in the wrong direction. And if we drill where we now know from the seismic the structure is sitting, instead of just drilling the edge of it and getting a sniff, we'll actually get the meat and potatoes, the main structure that we're trying to drill into.
So if you're drilling into a trap and there is helium and natural gas there, is it better to have one well to extract the material, or is it better to have multiple wells?
So it depends on the porosity of the formation, how the gas flows within the formation. But we do know that helium flows pretty easily. But once you drill the well and get the data, that's a classic petroleum reservoir engineering question, is what's the economics of drilling more wells and getting more gas quicker versus just spending more money than you need to. So that's then becomes extraction economics question after the discovery.
And so if you drill a well into a trap, I mean, let's imagine for the sake of a simple geological hypothetical that it's sort of a hollow structure. Obviously, it's full of gas and other substances. But if you yeah. put a hole into the top of it, is that your well, or does other yeah. bits of kit go into it?
So it might be easier to think of like a layer cake. We've got maybe eight layers. Layer number seven is something thick and creamy, and you want to push, think of drilling a hole a bit like pushing a straw down, or you're actually drilling the hole, and you'll get flow down the drill pipe or the straw. It comes up the outside, and you're constantly sampling what's coming back up out of the hole. And so as you drill down, if it's got no gas in it, you get no gas readings. As you go through that salt layer, you won't get any gas coming out of the salt bed. And then suddenly, when you start drilling below the salt bed, and the formation is a carbonate, or a bit like a reef, or a bit like chalk. And so the gas is sitting in between in the spaces in the rock. So as you drill a hole in that carbonate rock, then gas starts to come out through the porosity and the interconnections and comes up into the hole. And that's when you then start to get data at the surface. So you're looking for the pressure, you're looking for the constituents of the gas, and then in due course you look at how that will flow, and then you test that, flow it over a period of time, understand the reservoir pressure, and then design your production facility on the back of that. And usually gas will flow naturally, so you just cement the steel pipe in the ground and the gas will flow. So, for example, some of the wells on this production acreage that we bought were drilled in the 1990s, and they're still flowing oil to this day. But they started out with several hundred barrels a day of oil, and now they're each well's flowing several barrels a day, but it still continues to flow. And that's typically what happens when you first drill in. It'll flow very quickly, then it will reduce over time, but continuing to flow. I just love the physics, love the geology, and find it fascinating.
Yeah, it comes across. So does that mean that you mentioned that the gas sort of is present in sort of small packages, I suppose would be one very loose metaphorical way of putting it, inside the porous rock. Do you get the porous yep. rock coming up as waste product as well when you drill into it?
No, it's if you think of it like a stick of chalk, it's kind of cemented together by its nature. The carbonates, typically they're shells which are compressed and then kind of cemented together. But there's naturally gaps and holes between the shells, and the gas finds its way through each of those tiny holes into the next tiny hole, into the next channel, into the next gap, and works its way into the hole that you've drilled into the carbonate rock.
Right. So you just have to get into the carbonate rock, and then you can get flow.
Yeah, that's it.
And how sort of typically tiny are these holes?
Oh, microscopic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about where you go from that point then. So what's the general, speaking very generally, what's a sort of average timescale between discovery and production in the helium world?
So we've got an example for London investors. You'll see Helium 1 has just drilled a production well, and they started drilling not long ago. I think it was maybe a week or so, and they've just announced that they've reached the target depths, the total depths of the well, about I think it was 1,200 feet, and they will just then put a top on that well with a pipe attached to it, and that well will then be able to start flowing, and you can rent a production facility, plumb it in, and so that can be online and producing in a very short period of time. Now, each area then has some approvals process for various things. So certainly you would have, before you drill, you have a certain degree of environmental approval, and it depends where you are. So it's relatively business friendly in the US. Colorado does care about their nature, so they're keen to have environmental surveys. But once you go down that approval process, then it's relatively straightforward. As I say, trucks will come by and take it out of the storage tanks and take it off to market. So it's doesn't need to be a long time period at all where you've got all of that infrastructure. On the other hand, Helium 1 drilling and exploring in Africa, and that's going to take a bit longer to get that on production, but probably more like the typical remote oil and gas field. You know, that's typically sort of 2 years of development before you get into production. But in the US, I mean, we were drilling oil wells in Texas, and it's the same sort of thing. The oil flows into the tanks, the road tanker comes up, takes the oil out of the tanks, and off it goes to local market. And Helium's in the US is more like that.
Yeah, so it's in this sense, it's much more in line with the oil and gas sector than it is in the mining sector.
Yeah, you don't have to dig a big hole. You don't have to have necessarily a big processing plant. So it can be start off as small and fit for purpose. And then obviously as it gets bigger, you then look at cost effectiveness of bigger plants and infrastructure like pipelines.
Yeah, which explains why investors have been quite interested in Helium in recent years, I suppose, because they can have a quicker return on their investment.
Yeah, indeed.
So what do you think about the statement that that London is establishing itself as a sort of a hub for Helium companies as opposed to Australia or Canada? Is there any validity in saying something like that?
Well, yeah, I think there is. You can see... I think Helium 1 was one of the lead companies and established people thinking about helium. So they did a great job on that. And then out of that, the Helix was started by the former MD of Helium 1. And so he got that company floated. You know, there haven't been that many resource floats around the world in the last 4 or 5 years. It's so Helium has had Helix, Georgina Energy, and with Mossman we didn't do an IPO. We had Helium assets, but we have pivoted and focused on both our Helium assets in Australia, which we've now converted to a royalties in order to have the helium upside without spending a lot of money on drilling expensive wells, and got some great projects in the US that we're very pleased to switch across and focus on because of the benefits like infrastructure and markets and availability of services and, you know, to be honest, business-friendly environment.
So what's the latest on your US assets then?
So just at the in the last few months, we've acquired two leases that we're happy if we got one out of the two sets, but we got both of them, so we're very happy. They're adjacent. There's a lot of synergies. One is an area that hasn't been leased before, so we've from the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. It's technically very exciting. It's got 3D seismic, and we can see the structures. There's quite a few structures that we've focused on leasing that area, and already started technical work. And next door to that, what we're calling the Sagebrush project, has existing oil production, existing wells, which is great infrastructure to have that production facilities. There is a pipeline that goes through that lease, which is not currently being used, but was used as a gas pipeline. And there's seismic over that area as well. So we're really looking forward to doing the technical work that's necessary before drilling, getting the approvals, and drilling that area as soon as we can. But more probably earlier on the time frame is we have paired up with a company called Vector in Colorado that's doing similar exploration work that Helium One is doing with an Australian listed company called Blue Star Helium. Vector drill some wells with Blue Star Helium. Now they've taken their own leases and we have partnered with them. They have contracted a drilling rig to drill five wells, and we're really looking forward to getting those wells drilled in the near future.
Are they expensive to drill?
Now, these are the ones that are drilled under the water well license, and remarkably low cost. We're talking budget of something like 250,000 US to get a well drilled and get a gas test, which is remarkably low cost and one of the reasons that we were attracted into this project.
I mean, it sounds like a loophole, Andy, the water well license. Is there any danger that someone's going to come back and say, we didn't enjoy the fact that you drilled for helium under a water well license?
Now, there's a limitation. You can't produce other than water. So it's great for an exploration test well, and
Right.
then it's appropriate and necessary to apply for production wells, which then have a different approval process for permanent gas production wells. But it's landowners are very happy because if you do find water, then they get a water well. So you've got it's actually quite useful to very happy landowners, big ranches out there, and if you gave them a water well, you'll be friend for life. So we can test for gas, and then if there's any water that we can deliver, we do that on the way out of the finishing up on the well.
Yeah, water table issues can be quite big news in the US, can't they? And it sort of become a bit political.
So certainly water is precious at that high levels in the mountains, but we're just talking about water wells for a ranch. We're not talking about huge depleting any water zones.
If you discover water in your exploration efforts there, would that light be likely to be significantly separate from any helium and natural gas discovery?
So the big zone that does contain the helium is demonstrated at some of the other projects. Typically has helium in the top part of the sandstone, and may or may not have water in the lower part. So part of the exploration discovery is where is the water in that well. But for the rancher, there's potential for water zones much higher up, which is more normal for a water well not to be drilled as deep as we are going. But we will check and see if there's any water zones that are any use to the rancher. But our main target is the sandstone at 1200 feet or so, which is predominantly helium and may or may not have some water in the bottom part of it.
So what would success like? You talked earlier in our conversation about the types of grades of helium that are considered economic. In this drilling that you're talking about undertaking fairly soon, will you get indications both of grade and size?
Yeah, so the key criteria are helium content, which is by physical sample, and you also want to see flow rates, which you get from a number of sources. You can run electric logs and look at the porosity and deduce it that way, but ideally you actually just want to let the well flow and see what rates it flows at, and preferably not run into a bunch of water because that can mess up your gas well.
You're allowed to
But
let
there,
it flow, are you, under a water license?
no, you wouldn't. We wouldn't just leave it to flow. But for the benefit of the rancher, we put steel pipe in if it's a viable water source for the ranch. But our main focus in spending the money and drilling the well is to test for the helium potential, both in terms of it being there and the flow rates from the rock, and we collect all that data while we're drilling.
So that's going to be an exciting period for you guys.
Yeah, indeed.
And are you interested in looking for helium projects anywhere else? Or are you happy with the portfolio that you've currently got?
Yeah, we've got quite a broad portfolio. We're very happy with the areas that we're involved in Australia. There's definitely high potential, but some higher costs. And we think all the ingredients are right in the part of the States. And we did an overview, and we got the projects that we wanted. So we're very happy with the reasonably broad portfolio. Never like to put all eggs in one basket, so we're happy with our spread. That allows us to allocate capital according to a number of reasons. And for example, the lower well cost in the US, but also, the seismic cost is about a fraction of the cost it is in Australia. So we can just move forward faster and allocate our capital and our management efforts. We see the US as being a much better area for us to focus.
And do you think the high helium price is here to stay?
Oh yeah, I mean the big storage that was in Kansas, that's gone. It's not there anymore. And global supply, you look at what's happening as the geopolitics. You go, if you're manufacturing in the US, I know where I'm going to get my helium supply from. So we're very happy, and we don't see helium price heading south anytime soon. It's more a question of how much higher and for how much longer.
So before we wrap it up, Andy, is there any sort of other sort of interesting points about helium or Mossman that you think are worth covering off on?
I don't know if it'll have interest to anyone. Our man in the US, Howard, is an astrophysicist as a hobby, and he's telling me that the sun is predominantly helium and hydrogen, and it's actually an atomic bomb which is consuming the helium and hydrogen, and that's powering the Earth right now. So it puts kind of puts it in a universal perspective. You've got the two most common elements. Well, they're pulled into the sun and burning up and giving us our sunshine and our warmth every day.
Yeah, so we're all powered by helium.
Yeah, big nuclear reaction of helium and hydrogen.
Excellent. Well, that's a great place to end. Thanks very much for talking us through helium today, Andy, and good luck with Mossman and all your future endeavours.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at cinfin.com.